Welcome, everybody. We're going to get started. Our last panelist is trailing by just a few minutes, which is fine. We have a presentation at the front end, and then we'll have panelist reactions. I'm Zav Briggs. I'm Vice President for Economic Opportunity and Markets. Can you hear me okay in the back?
Not
quite? Okay, we're going to work on the mic here. I'm Vice President of the Ford Foundation. It is a privilege and a delight to be moderating this panel on affordable housing and what New York City should look like and work like in the year 2040. We're going to look ahead. We're going to discuss some bold ideas. And here's what we'll do. I'll say introductions in a moment. And we will lead off with a presentation from Moses Gates, who's at my far left, your far right, Director of Community Planning and Design for the RPA. And then I'll invite reactions from the panel, and then we will open it up to you. So who's here with me? To my immediate left, we've got Mike Slattery. He's Senior VP for Research at the Real Estate Board of New York. Mike's job is to develop policy views and represent those views for the real estate industry on a wide variety of policy issues. To Mike's left is Michelle Delahousse. She's Executive Director of the Fifth Avenue Committee, a community development corporation in Brooklyn, a nationally respected CDC, I might add. And she's the former co-chair of FAC, which manages a large affordable housing portfolio, has a large development pipeline as well, and does a variety of non-housing programs in addition. Next to Michelle is Rick Jacobus. He's principal of Street Level Urban Impact Advisors. And Rick is a leading expert nationally on inclusionary housing and affordable home ownership. For example, he's the author of a guidebook called Inclusionary Housing, Creating and Maintaining Equitable Communities. And he also founded something called the Cornerstone Partnership, focused on long-run housing affordability. Next to Rick is Carl Weisbrod. Carl is director of New York City Planning and chair of the Planning Commission. He was appointed by Mayor de Blasio in March of 2014, and Carl has held a wide variety of public and private leadership roles on development issues here in New York City. Next to Carl is Rachelle.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Rachelle LaForest. She is on the steering committee of the Right to the City Alliance, a grassroots organizing and advocacy group whose work includes a national campaign called Homes for All, and Rachelle is also the former executive director of the Right to the City Alliance. And next to her is Moses, and Moses will kick it off. He'll present the major elements of the affordable housing proposals in the regional plan, and then what I'll do is I'll go to Carl and Mike for government and business perspectives, and then we'll turn squarely to community development by asking Michelle and Rachelle their views. And then, Rick, I'm going to turn to you last to zoom out a bit, give us a national and a comparative perspective, because these challenges and many of the solutions are not unique to New York City, and we'd like to get some national perspective from you. So over to Moses.
All right. Thanks for coming. So it's almost a cliche at this point to say we have a housing crisis here in New York City. It's been going on for decades, and it just seems to get worse and worse. You can see that the amount of households spending over 35% of their income on housing has increased. It's increased across the board throughout the region, but it continues to be the worst in New York City, up about 10% percentage points from 1990 to 2010, and now over 40% of households spend more than 35% of their income on housing. And this is distributed differently throughout the region. You can see this is what's left over after housing and transportation costs. And in almost all of the Bronx and large swaths of Brooklyn and Queens, the answer is almost nothing. Households have very, very little after accounting for housing and transportation. And this really affects our local economy, less to spend on local businesses, less to save, less ability to get ahead. And when you have a housing crisis like this, it affects everybody. But as you move up the income ladder, people start to have options. You start to cut some discretionary items to match the rising rent, maybe move to a little bit of a less expensive neighborhood. But for folks who are already in the cheapest neighborhoods, don't have the ability to move, don't have anything else left to cut from their budgets, you're starting to see the end game of what happens in the housing squeeze. And this is what really makes this housing crisis a little different from all other housing crises. Over the last 10 years, you start to see one end result of an unaffordable city, which is homelessness, which is almost double in the last 10 years. And the other thing that gets talked about a little bit less is overcrowding. There are 45,000 more overcrowded households in New York City in 2014 than in 2008. We're adding about 20 overcrowded units a day here in New York City. And this is what happens when folks don't have other options. They go into the shelter system or they start to double up. So we obviously have to do something. We have to do something big. We need a real course correction in our housing policy, not just in New York City, but throughout the region. And we need to do four things here in New York. We need to encourage effective development. We need to unlock hidden housing. We need to make sure there's affordability everywhere. And as we encourage development, we need to combat some of the bad side effects that can happen with development, namely harassment and displacement. So one of the things that constrains our housing production, especially in our high-density areas, is we are not allowed to build more than 12.0 floor area ratio, 12 times the land that the building sits on. And this is something that kind of can cap housing production. Before this rule was put in place, there were many buildings, many really nice buildings that were built larger than 12.0. We have 1040 Fifth Avenue, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis's old home, 13.06 FAR, and some of the commercial conversions downtown, like 20 Exchange Place and 70 Pine Street behind it, have FARs of about 30. And these conversions from commercial to residential have really helped make downtown more vibrant, more of a 24-hour city, and I think folks will be really improve the overall neighborhood. Now, when you build denser, you need to build infrastructure to support that density. You need the schools, you need the fire stations, you need the sewer systems if you're not in a place that has them, and you need the open space. Now, the good news is a lot of our high-density areas used to be even denser. Manhattan is actually 30% below its peak population, and still about 16% below its peak its population from 1950. So there's still room to add more people. One of the hard things to add when you develop, though, is open space, but increasingly we're seeing that open space doesn't necessarily need to be on street level. Things like the High Line, the Low Line, two new observation decks that are slated to open shows there's really an appetite for public space above and in some cases even below ground. And San Francisco has done a great job of putting public space on roofs and terraces. That's a building in on Market Street in San Francisco. And London, increasingly, is doing this also. That's slated to be the second tallest building in London, 22 Bishopsgate, with three stories of free and open public space on the top of the building. Now, if we're going to build denser, it can't just be physical density. It has to be effective density that adds significantly to our housing stock. So I want to contrast two buildings, both prominent additions to the skyline over the last few years, both super tall buildings, 8 Spruce and 432 Park Avenue. They might look similar, tall Manhattan towers, but the way that they're built is actually very different. You can see in 8 Spruce Street, there's almost 900 apartments, averaging about 750 square feet per apartment, whereas 432 Park is almost 4,000 square feet of apartment. And if we're going to build large buildings, they need to have a lot of apartments in order to really reduce our housing crisis. Now, city planning has recently made high-density development able to build a little smaller apartments, and that has the effect of taking where before you could build 10 apartments, now you can build about 11. But what if we reverse that? What if we changed our tax code and changed our building code to discourage these extra large units, and instead of having, say, one 20,000 square foot apartment, encourage 10 2,000 square foot apartments? That would add a lot more to our housing stock to relieve our affordability crisis. But it's not just our high-density areas, Manhattan, Long Island City, Brooklyn, that we need to be thinking about increasing density. We also really need to be thinking about this throughout the suburbs. The more suburban parts of New York City, I should say, in addition to the suburbs. Increasing transit-oriented development and building denser around transit stations is a big part of our suburban solutions. But that can't just be extended to the counties outside of New York City. It also has to be extended within New York City itself. These are areas in New York City that are within 1/2 mile of transit that are zoned for less than 1.0 floor area. And even on top of this, there are actually 4.5 square miles within the 5 boroughs that are not historic districts, I should add that, that are within 1/2 mile of transit, where it is illegal to build anything other than single-family detached homes of at least 2,850 square feet. This is a building that is a 6-minute walk from an express subway stop with a 20-minute ride to Midtown. And this developer is not allowed to build anything other than a one-family home. This building could easily become two semi-detached duplex apartments, not increase the physical envelope of the building, and have 4 times the amount of housing that it does today. So rezoning these areas, these transit-oriented, extremely low-rise areas for multifamily development, this increases density without, increases effective density without necessarily increasing the physical density. In addition to building more housing, we need to unlock the housing we already have. And a rough estimate from RPA is that if we legalized accessory dwelling units, we could get almost 100,000 new, currently unoccupied housing units without stacking one brick on top of another, just by unlocking the potential housing we have. And another way to unlock hidden housing, and when I researched this, this is what really stood out to me, is there are 167,000 units in New York City that are vacant and not on the market. If you were to take all the vacant units in Manhattan that are currently not on the market, that are used as pied-à-terres, investment housing, Airbnb, any other kind of mostly vacant but unavailable units, you would increase the vacancy rate in Manhattan to 11.2%. And if we need to really think about reforming our tax code to encourage resident occupancy and discourage non-resident occupancy here in New York City. And if we're going to build everywhere, we need to build affordable everywhere, not constraining this to a few neighborhoods in New York City. So here is everywhere in New York that's also not a historic district and zoned for dense multifamily housing, 4.0 FAR and above. And overlaid, you can see these are the inclusionary zoning designated areas with the voluntary program. And it's in a few areas, but it leaves out a big chunk of central Manhattan, downtown Manhattan, and lots of other areas where not only could the market leverage affordable housing, it could leverage that affordable housing in areas where it's currently extremely difficult to build because of the high costs. Transit-oriented areas, areas with greater opportunity that we can get affordable housing in if we expand inclusionary zoning to a broader area instead of just doing it neighborhood by neighborhood. And if we're going to have a conversation about affordability everywhere, our tax exemption policy needs to be part of the conversation. Now, market rate housing without tax exemptions under the former 421A program produced housing not just in Manhattan, but a lot of different places in the 5 boroughs. And in fact, you can see the Corona Elmhurst area in Queens is one of the places that utilized 421A the most. Right there. And the market rate, the going market rate for a new condo in Queens is about $376,000. A $400,000 condo in today's environment to low interest rates that doesn't pay real estate taxes is actually affordable to what we call a moderate income family, 120% of our area median income. So we can produce moderate middle income housing just by using the market and a tax exemption throughout a lot of the boroughs. But we have to make sure that this is a long-term investment, not just a short-term production policy. And the way we can do that is by making contingent upon this exemption that it's either 100% rent-stabilized housing or it's available to first-time home buyers to increase equity and stabilize neighborhoods. Now, what about the areas where the market doesn't produce affordable housing? In these areas, we need to think about taking that tax exemption, leveraging it for very deeply affordable housing that that market can support, and also putting a cap on the total exemption so it doesn't become an inefficient program. Under the old 421A, there are areas in Manhattan that would have a tax expenditure of over $1 million to create an affordable unit. We need to make sure that a new program doesn't become that inefficient anywhere in New York City. And if we're going to build, and we need to build, we need to really combat the side effects and the bad side effects that come with this building, which is harassment and displacement. And you're getting kind of a preview of this. We have started to map throughout the entire region areas we think are currently have a high risk of displacement, and also areas in the future that we think are going to have a high risk of displacement. And you can see it's a whole lot in New York City, almost all of Brooklyn, a good swath of Queens, lots of Upper Manhattan in the Bronx. Now, we have an anti-harassment zoning provision, but again, just like inclusionary zoning, it's only in a couple of neighborhoods. But it's not just a couple of neighborhoods that are undergoing displacement pressure. We need to take that anti-harassment zoning, extend it citywide, and we also need to extend a right to counsel in housing court for tenants citywide. Having housing counsel is the single biggest preventer of eviction and homelessness. And each homeless family in New York City costs us almost $40,000 to shelter every year. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to the panel.
Moses, thanks so much. You. Thank you for racing through the major strategies, but giving us, I think, just enough about how these changes would be accomplished that the panel has quite a lot to react to. Let's start with Carl Weisbrot.
Well, I have Moses had a very bold and broad program, and I have very limited time to react to it. So let me just say, touch on a few things. And actually, let me start with the panel this morning and the tension between growth and affordability, because that's really what is fueling the affordability crisis. I mean, in many ways, New York City and other major cities around the country are in the very best of times. Urban centers are very popular, and New York is particularly popular. And our city is growing, and our population, albeit, as Moses said, not in Manhattan, but in every other borough, is at record levels and is continuing to grow. And that fundamentally is what's fueling the affordability crisis in New York. And as I'm not going to repeat it here, but the city and the de Blasio administration has responded to that with, I think, the boldest, most thoughtful, certainly the most aggressive and comprehensive affordable housing program in the country, including the most rigorous mandatory inclusionary housing program in the country, including allocating $8 billion over 10 years just to subsidize affordable housing, and including many changes in our zoning that reduces the cost of building affordable housing and all other forms of housing, including, as Moses said, reducing the minimum unit size so that we can get more affordable units. And frankly, we had asked for more than the city council gave us in terms of reducing affordability. I'd like to just very, very briefly respond to some of the proposals that Moses made. One, with respect to the 12 FAR cap on residential development, which we agree is, in this day and age, is not necessary, especially since we don't have a cap on commercial development. And the origins of the 12 FAR cap are murky, to be sure. We're not exactly clear where that came from. It is a state cap. It's not something that we can change without the state legislature. But it is especially an impediment because that 12 FAR cap really is focused on our high-density districts, which have the most transit infrastructure and the most infrastructure that to absorb additional residential use. And someone who was part of the effort to transform Lower Manhattan and make it into a mixed-use community, one of our first endeavors was to promote the conversion of older office buildings to residential use, whereas Moses said the 12 FAR cap doesn't exist. And that's been highly successful. I think there are other areas where which are more problematic, and this is based on certainly the experience we went through very recently with respect to inclusionary zoning and zoning for quality. And the main, I think the main issue that we face as a city and all urban cities face is this conflict between neighborhoods that want to maintain the way of life that they have and what they see as their quality of life, their fear of change, and their resistance in many, many, many instances to rezonings, particularly in low-density neighborhoods. And this exists neighborhoods throughout the city. For every neighborhood that we are proposing a rezoning to increase density, we probably get requests from five neighborhoods to reduce density and to limit development. And the example that Moses gave of a one-family building becoming a two-family building in zones which have been zoned for two, three, four, five, six-story, six-family units, but are actually one, two-family units. If that neighborhood starts to see three or four-family units being built, we have an enormous reaction on our hands. So I don't want to minimize the difficulty and the challenge of creating greater density, particularly in low-density neighborhoods. I would say that's a really significant issue that we face. We do agree that we should be looking at accessory dwelling units. There are tens of thousands in the city. The issues associated with them are enormously complicated, and we are more than willing to engage in a pilot program with any neighborhood, any elected official who would like to see a pilot program in his or her district to try to legalize those units. We've had seen very, very few hands go up from volunteers. And that, in part, is because the issues that are raised include health and safety issues, neighborhood character issues, density issues, again, conflicts between existing occupants of those units, the owners of those units, all of which make the endeavor extremely complicated, although it certainly is one that we would are more than willing to take on, at least on a pilot basis. Maybe I should stop there.
Thanks,
but, and answer questions and respond as we go forward.
Fantastic. Thank you. So, Mike, we've heard a set of proposals by Moses. Carl has touched on, given us a policy perspective and outlined a number of governance challenges. And from both, we've heard about a variety of market incentives, things that get to interests of property owners, but also of tenants who do not own real estate. So give us an industry perspective.
Well, a couple of things. I did hear Moses' preliminary presentation yesterday, but there weren't a lot of numbers to it, so the numbers here are kind of helpful in that. My initial thought was to look at it, this issue from a different perspective. And in a different setting, Carl had said that the city needs 500,000 more units to address our growing population as well as to address our affordable housing shortage. I repeat that number not because Carl said it, because I think it's correct. So the question, I think, is how do we get to that level of production that will help to alleviate our housing crisis? And some of the issues here seem to address some of them in large numbers, the accessory units, for example. But some of these have also been tested or not been tested, but they've just not been implemented for the reasons that Carl cited. Likewise, the creating greater density in single-family home neighborhoods also seems to be problematic. It wasn't long ago that we were downzoning neighborhoods throughout the city to protect neighborhood character. Not much in the way of criticism about that. There was a lot of cheering to make that happen because that was what the neighborhood wanted. But now we find ourselves being somewhat hamstrung in how much more density we can put in those locations. And I think if we look at what has been successful in terms of housing production, I think you have to look at those places where density, there's been high density rezonings. Certainly Hudson Yards has been a catalyst for new development. West Chelsea, 6th Avenue, and just a small example of a change where neighborhood character was in kind of combating with what I would call more high-density development. In 1997, the city rezoned four blocks, basically four corners on 97th Street and Lexington Avenue. And in that rezoning basically produced about 650 units of housing in just those four blocks. A few years later, the city wanted to rezone East Harlem, 354 blocks, and the EIS for that study proposal said that it was going to create 354 more units of housing over the next decade. So the question we were asking is, why are we doing this? What's the, you know, when we have an example of where going from a 3 FAR to a 9 FAR produces housing very significantly and very dramatically and increases the numbers, why are we moving to a proposal which basically contextualizes neighborhoods, limits development opportunities, and basically restricts our growth and our ability to hit a number? You know, all of these things are nice, but I think we've got to realize what is our goal here? How are we going to solve this problem? Some of the issues that Moses addresses, you know, will be effective. I was actually taken back, maybe I'm smirking on this, but we talked about the vacant units. I was saying to myself, if those vacant units are now put on the market, does that raise our vacancy level above 5% and we can end rent regulations? So, you know, we'll have to look into that as an alternative. But I think the idea is, yes, there are that's been out there for a while. You know, there's the speculation that people are hoarding them. But, you know, sometimes apartments need to be renovated. And, you know, we see that especially the older they get, the more time they need to get renovated. So, look, I think that RPA's view of trying to produce housing is great, certainly around the transit areas. But I think if we're going to do it around those transit areas, we've got to do it at greater densities. I would commend the administration. I think what they tried to do in East New York is one example of where the density was increased significantly, probably not as much as we would like, but we never are satisfied. But I think it's that kind of approach where you are increasing opportunities in places where you actually have land shift opportunities. And if we can do that and kind of push back a little bit to say that the most important need for the city of New York is housing and affordable housing, and our neighborhood character may take a little bit of a hit, because look, these planners are not in, you know, they don't ignore neighborhood character. They are guided by that as much as anyone else and are trying to address a more serious problem. So I would think that, and I would suggest, and our perspective would be to look at rezonings in ways that would be much more aggressive. Yes, we need to worry about the concerns about displacement that would create. But we also should keep in mind that sometimes there are housing units that are under-occupied and could be a development site, and we need to find a way to move forward to allow that site to be developed, protecting the people who are already in there. So, again, I would commend, you know, RPA for looking at this in a broad range of issues, but I think there are other tools that are out there that we should be looking at to make this achieve the goal of 500,000 units in the next 15, 20 years.
Mike, that's really helpful. Thank you. One of the things I want to make sure we get some views on is how to expand housing opportunity, address neighborhood character, while adding the additional units needed. No one here, I think, is politically naive about where the resistance comes from to some of these changes, but the city now, in doing upzoning, for example, is addressing broader issues of neighborhood quality, neighborhood enhancement. That's something I think we'll hear a range of views on. Let's go to Rochelle for the next few, and then we'll come down.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. So it was mentioned earlier that I was the former executive director of Right to the City Alliance for 5 years. I've now sit on the steering committee, and I'm currently the director of the Retail Action Project. So I am engaging still a low-wage and working-class community, but in the realm of retail, And it's a very helpful place to sit coming with a housing background so that I think I take a very holistic view of the neighborhood and development as it's happening, not only looking at the dwelling, but really looking at the ecosystem of a community. I want to commend this process, both the forward thinking really having a conversation about what we can do to have New York be an affordable city over the next 20 years. Also, the RPA's engagement of the local community. So Right to the City is a national alliance of 58 local member organizations, and a number of our member organizations have been a part of this community engagement process. And it's actually, as we look forward to 2040, a process that I think needs to be deeply invested in and double down on, because these are the spaces where our communities have no say and are not able to be at the table in order to really speak very truthfully about what it is they need, want, and would like to see in their communities. So I commend, you know, I commend this process and think that it's something that we definitely need to grow. I think that the fact that RPA has an organization like Right to the City and the local member organizations of ours in New York City at the table is a sign that there's a shift, and we're seeing that shift in lots of different cities. And there's a significance to the shift, and I think it says a lot about the political moment. So since 2007, 2008, we hit yet another financial crisis, not the first, though a highly well-publicized one, and one that hit the middle class in a way that it had never been hit before. And so it has generated a narrative and a shift in politics within the working class and the middle class that's very distinct and very different than we've seen in the last several decades. So you look at Occupy and Black Lives Matter and Bernie Sanders, who very publicly claims, you know, a pseudo-socialist stance and puts out an agenda that looks very different than one that we've seen the Democratic Party put out in a long time, and now Trump as the likely nominee of the GOP. And I think you can see that the political climate of our city, our region, our country, even the globe, has shifted in a very real way. And I raise that because I think we have an opportunity between now and 2040 to ride that wave and actually grow that shift and that push when it comes to thinking about how we plan and what we do in our communities. And I would encourage the RPA and other organizations to actually get a little bit brazen around how we define and lead with our values, right? So the policies that get passed in any municipality or in a state or in the country are a reflection of the values of the people who are decision makers. And it's our job as those who elect them or get behind them to push and shape how they express those values and inform what those values look like. And I wonder what it would look like to begin a process like this with a value of development without displacement, as opposed to making an assumption that displacement is an automatic consequence of development. Like I've heard many people, you know, define gentrification as a natural phenomenon. Gentrification is just something that happens naturally as development moves. And I think in Right to the City and for our local organizations, we really push back and reject this notion that this is natural and not very deliberate and very decided. And so what does it mean to begin a planning process starting from a point of development without displacement? Looking for a way to not to displace anyone, right? Because there are many who equate gentrification with community development, when in fact they are very distinctly different from one another. Community development happens in the best interest of and for the community that currently exists in a particular neighborhood. Gentrification is looking to develop and bring in a different class of community, and thereby has gentrification as an outcome, as a very expected outcome. And it's important to be able to make that distinction. So just in terms of framing how we move forward towards 2040, I would encourage all of us to think about what it would feel like to sort of try on that shirt of development without displacement. And so in that vein, there's a few things that I would offer for in terms of the recommendations that are being put forward. So one is this very magic and important double-sided coin of rent control and just cause eviction, right? Both the protection of the existing community, the people who already live in a neighborhood slated to be rezoned or developed, in terms of what they pay in rent and ensuring affordability that may already exist, and then just cause eviction so that when landlords... Is that my timer? Is that just...
No, no.
I was going to say, I didn't hear that for anybody else. That was
just a soundtrack.
And just cause eviction, which many of our groups are passing at the local level in cities around the country, so that when a development, when a rezoning takes place and landlords or private developers, many of whom we're finding now are private hedge funds, right, who are taking serious advantage of the foreclosure crisis, converting single-family homes to insanely unaffordable rentals, and then speculating with those on the market in the same way it was done in 2008. That's like a whole other panel discussion. But what is it that prevents developers from being able to both price out the people who want to move in or live there already and displace folks who are there? So I would offer rent control and just cause eviction and being able to include those in a proposal like this and pass them as parallel entities, because both are critical in order to preserve neighborhood character. Second, I think for us, we think what's really important is this. I love the way that it's explained in the slideshow, unlocking hidden housing, right? Preservation of affordable housing that already exists, in our opinion, should be prioritized over new development, or equally as prioritized with new development. And let's talk about a very particular stock of housing that is divested from on a regular basis, public housing. So here's an enormous means of providing consistently affordable housing for low-income communities in this city. And rather than being invested in and well-maintained, it is specifically and deliberately allowed to become dilapidated because, according to particular business plans that we see roll out in New York and other cities, this is exactly the stock of housing that's slated for demolition in order to make room for perhaps a mixed-income luxury development. There's a lot of problems, I think, with the inclusionary zoning and the mixed income, and I'm going to get to that a little bit later. But
Rachelle, let me ask you just to take another minute, though, to bring this first round to a close. We're doing quick reactions. I need to get in Michelle and Rick also.
Yes.
Just make a few more,
okay,
and then we'll come back.
So then I'll hit mixed income and inclusionary zoning.
Okay.
At Right to the City and with our member organizations, the problem that we find is that the dwelling is regarded as something that is separate from the rest of the community. And that, how is that ever the case where we live? You know, we live in an ecosystem so that the dwelling is intrinsically a component of the broader community. And so what happens when an inclusionary zoning plan passes and a mixed income development goes up and there's 100 units out of, say, 1,000 units that get slated for affordable housing? Forget about the fact that true affordability is not well calculated or, you know, arrived at in this city and many other cities. But over time, the surrounding services in the neighborhood change to meet the needs of those who can pay more. So where I had a small neighborhood bodega or a small chain grocery store, there's now a Whole Foods. And where there was the bodega for my morning cup of coffee, now there's a Starbucks. Where there was a free clinic, now we've got a private hospital. Public schools that my kids went to are now being replaced by charter schools, and so on and so forth. So when we look at the dwelling, we actually have to really think about how the neighborhood shifts to meet the needs of the people who can shell out a lot more money and what we do to protect the neighborhood character mm-hmm. of those who want to stay and need to be able to afford a healthy and sustainable life.
That's great. Sorry to pause you there, but we'll come back, I promise. Michelle, what's your take?
Sure. First off, just want to say thank you for the invitation, and I think that the conversation has put a lot of the tensions on the table that I think we all have known have been present. Just a little bit of background. So on the maps that Moses showed, Fifth Avenue Community's catchment area is that section in Brooklyn where there's in particular been some really significant development, very limited voluntary inclusionary housing that's actually been mapped. And you know, we cover downtown Brooklyn, we cover Park Slope, we cover Red Hook and Sunset Park. You know, obviously very, very different neighborhoods, some of whom have seen extensive gentrification and displacement pressures over the last 38 years that the organization has been around. And, you know, we've seen things like Atlantic Yards where there's significant density given with very little affordability. Even if the number of affordable units is high, the depth of affordability is something that's very, very challenging. And so, you know, that's the experience that we've had. We've seen rezonings that have actually resulted in the both direct and indirect displacement of folks. So we really understand the power of government action and how important government action is in terms of signaling to the market about what is acceptable and what is required. And obviously, a lot of these things obviously, you know, happened under the previous administration. And part of the whole issue here is really about learning from those mistakes. And I think that's something that the de Blasio administration has certainly tried to do. And I think, you know, based on the points that Moses made, you know, and I think that Rochelle made, you know, we've really reached the point of peak incrementalism in the country in terms of dealing with the level of challenge that we have in terms of inequality and issues of justice. And that really requires very, very significant and bold government action. And certainly MIH and ZQA and, you know, having the most aggressive affordable housing plan of any municipality in the country is pretty bold. And the administration should be commended for that. The reality is we have to be bold on the other side. And really the points that I think Rochelle made about pressures around displacement, pressures... you know, the role that government action does play, or inaction plays, in terms of displacement and gentrification. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, we do have a supply and demand issue as it relates to housing in New York City, but that's not enough. The reality is, people really want to know, and the reason why I think people are fearful and are concerned is because they're concerned that they're not going to benefit from the change. And I think if people really saw that they were actually going to benefit from the change, that there'd be a shift in people's willingness to embrace the pace of change that is already going on and that is necessary for us to really address the population that is coming, while at the same time taking care of the population that's here. So I think, you know, those are some of the most significant things. And so I think a lot of it has to do with the order in which the actions are happening. You know, Moses outlined, obviously, about the right to counsel and the anti-harassment districts. You know, really, those should have been up front. I mean, we've had a very robust conversation in the last year and a half in the city about the trade-offs between density and affordability. We've had a pretty robust conversation about you know, how the building envelope contributes to the challenges in building affordable housing. I think we need to have a really robust conversation at all levels about what are the contributing factors to displacement. And I think we need to place that at the highest level of priority in the discussion in New York City. Because I think until that happens, then I think the population, and in particular the folks that Fifth Avenue Committee serves and works with, which is really low-income folks, are going to resist the change. And I think even middle-income folks are feeling the pressure at this point, given what's going on. And I certainly know that plenty of middle-income folks in Park Slope that are concerned about the investments being made in real estate in and around our area, you know, going to folks that, you know, people making those investments and not even living in the neighborhood. So those are real concerns that I think are contributing to the conversation. So I think a number of the ideas that RPA has put out are valid ones. I think it's the order matters. I think the emphasis matters. And I think that, you know, really, a lot of what is put on the table in that conversation is about political feasibility, and I think until we engage a broader group of people into how we are all going to benefit from New York City's growth, how is the growth going to be inclusive, then the political feasibility part of the equation is going to be missing, and I think that really hampers all of our abilities to achieve the goals that New York City needs to achieve to be an inclusive global city and to grow inclusively. So I'll stop there.
Michelle, thanks so much. So Rick, we've heard quite a range of ideas in the proposals themselves and in the views expressed, and a real mix, especially in the last couple of minutes, of a focus on, if you might say, incumbents, people who are living in communities already, in the context of a plan that takes a generational perspective. It's really about what New York City and its neighborhoods will need for a whole generation to come, and there will be continuous change. And the idea is to support a successful economy overall. Give us your perspective. How do you react to the conversation you've heard so far, and what might New York City learn from efforts elsewhere?
Sure. And so I'm the token non-New Yorker up here, so I'm not going to presume to say what you should do here in New York or what the answer to any of these questions are. I thought maybe it would make more sense for me to focus less on the how or the less on the what, but more on the why. Right? What's at stake? And you know, the I guess it's bad news really, but you're not alone in facing these kinds of issues. And in particular, this question around gentrification and displacement. And I've been really concerned. I live in California, and you're not surprised to hear that San Francisco has been dealing with this for a really long time. But I've been working in Seattle, Denver, even Atlanta, and Minneapolis. And in all of those places, these issues that these people are raising have become like a barrier to building the housing that you sort of need regionally. And some people are finding that really surprising. So, like, raise your hand if you're in the real estate industry. Anyone here in the real estate industry? Yeah, right? So you probably find that extremely counterintuitive, that the displacement would be a reason not to build more. But because, right, it's the supply and demand, and if the housing costs are really high, that's because we're not building enough, and if we want people to be able to afford to live in our cities, we just need to build more. That's the solution, right? And what I've seen is that it's actually a lot more complicated than that. And one of the things that's confounding the discussion is this confusion of the regional scale with the local scale. And that while a building that might add supply regionally might lower the aggregate rent across the region by some tiny amount, in a particular neighborhood, a new development, particularly a high-end luxury development, can dramatically increase rents in the surrounding property. And the reason for that, you know, maybe there's several, but one of them is the character of the neighborhood that changes, the perception of the neighborhood changes. And, you know, neighborhoods aren't as driven by supply and demand as regions are. We, if you think about the region, if you lined up all of the households in the region by income with the richest people over here and the lowest income people over here, you see everywhere that the richest people claim the most desirable places, and those are the most expensive places. And what happens is neighborhoods compete to land somewhere on that continuum. And while it takes a really long time to change the supply of housing in a neighborhood, you can change where a neighborhood falls pretty quickly in terms of where it's what the overall level of demand for the neighborhood is. And one of the things that can do that is new real estate development. So if you're a low-income resident in an urban, you know, high-growth urban region, the last thing you want to happen is for your neighborhood to sort of be discovered, right? Because you're going to have rising rents, you're going to have rising evictions, and even if you have rent control, the character of your neighborhood is going to change and it's not going to be your neighborhood anymore. So I don't think people are irrational to say that, you know, development is a threat to the, you know, quality of life and just even sort of ability of people to stay in their communities. But I say that at the same time that I recognize that concern about gentrification and displacement itself is one of the reasons we're not building enough. And that not building enough makes the problem even worse, and it's like a death spiral. The worse the problem gets, the harder it is to solve. Because more and more people are going to say, it's not just the, you know, the low-income communities of color now, it's middle-income communities are saying, we don't want luxury housing in our neighborhood, that's going to push our prices up too high. It's like this new NIMBYism, right? People don't want, so where are we going to put the rich people, right? So some of it is supply and demand, but there's another thing that's changed that's really important, which I like to think of as like a consumer preference, right? There's not that long ago, if you asked all the wealthy people where the most desirable places were, they pointed out. They said it's the far out suburbs. New York is a little bit of an exception relative to the rest of the country, but all across the country, they said way out there, that's where we want to live. And that has changed. And it's changed in a really fundamental way. And it's not, I don't think you see the change in the demographics as much as you see it in just the market. Wealthier people want to live in the city now. Right? It used to be you'd say inner city. That was like a euphemism for the least desirable part of the region. And it's just not, that's changed. People want to live near transit. They want to live near services. They want to live near jobs. And what's just tragic about that, to me, is that the displacement that we're seeing right now, a lot of the same families that are being pushed out of central urban neighborhoods are the families that were racially excluded from the suburban dream, right? Mm-hmm. So it's what's really just disheartening and frustrating about this is that this could be good news, right? We've had this research that I think has really changed the way people think about community development, and we're seeing a growing recognition that concentrated urban poverty is bad, and it's bad particularly for kids, and we need to promote more mixed-income communities, and there's a lot of, like, everybody seems to agree, mixed-income is a great thing. Most of our attention there has been focused on how do we get, you know, lower-income families into the high-opportunity suburbs, you know, sort of make that choice available to people. That's a really hard road to that goal. What should be a lot easier is to take our central neighborhoods and tap this new demand and extract from it the investment that we wanted all along, right? To say, let's bring some new investment in and let's bring some higher income in, but let's do it on our terms so that everybody benefits. And we can take away some of the negatives that have been associated with intense concentrations of poverty and have healthier communities. Now, how many of you live or work in or around low-income communities? Did you just roll your eyes? Right? When you say, oh, well, we're going to tap the benefit of growth and everyone's going to share in it, we all agree that's a good idea, but most of the people closest to that problem don't have any hope that that's a realistic outcome. It's because we've done a terrible job at sustaining mixed income, like across decades now. Whenever a neighborhood changes and higher income people move in, we have a mixed income community for a little while. And if it catches on, there's a tipping point where people start to get displaced, right? And that leads to a, I think, a totally appropriate cynicism that, you know, but we don't have to do that again. Like, we're at this turning point right now where the change in preference and the change in the way people think about cities creates this sort of once-in-a-generation opportunity to do it differently. We don't have to build racism and classism into our land use, into the, like, fabric of it.
Rick, can I stop you there? You've given us a very powerful, inclusive growth frame, in effect. Use the growth, but be very particular about building in affordability, development without displacement, and so on. But use that engine. Sort of echoes where Carl started us. Moses, I want to give you just a couple of minutes to react to a couple of the things you've heard in response to the plan. But take just a couple, because I want to get the audience in.
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing about the plan and the response is that, you know, there's still an assumption that the growth is going to happen in the low-income areas, and low-income areas are going to be the places that, you know, we're going to build higher-income housing and maybe some middle-income housing. But, you know, when you look spatially, it's really not just in the city, throughout the region, in the suburbs, the higher-income areas that have been downzoned and now are really hard to build, not just middle-income housing, but any housing at all. And so, you know, I agree with Rick that it's a hard road to hoe to kind of integrate higher income neighborhoods. But, you know, for Rochelle's point, like, we have to lead with our values. And, you know, I would say that it kind of has to be a both and. You can't, if you only make mixed income communities out of low income neighborhoods and you don't make mixed income communities out of high income neighborhoods, the math is really obvious there. So I would shoot that back and say, how can we kind of income integrate some of our higher income neighborhoods in the city?
Mm-hmm. And can I just could Carl, please, just quickly respond to that, because I think that's the whole notion behind mandatory inclusionary zoning, mm-hmm. which is to both allow some higher income people into low income neighborhoods while protecting permanently a proportion of that housing forever for low-income people, and also requiring, as we increase capacity, that low-income people move into high-income neighborhoods. And as I think probably everyone in this panel would agree, mixed-income neighborhoods, economically diverse neighborhoods, are going to be much healthier neighborhoods. And certainly for poor children, that the social evidence is pretty clear on that. And when we take an area like East New York, which is what we just rezoned and upzoned, we did it in a comprehensive way that included new schools, not charter schools, but public schools, more open space, mm-hmm. more and better streetscape, more services, because we recognize that a neighborhood doesn't only require more housing, it also requires a better quality of life. And I will say to Rachel that the East New York community, at least, wanted and wants and yearns for better retail. Yes, they want to protect, to some extent, the stores that are there now, but they also recognize that many of those stores are inadequate and are not providing the kinds of services that they would like, and they actually welcome a Whole Foods. They welcome a Trader Joe's. They welcome more supermarkets. We've heard that from East New York and, frankly, every community that we're engaged in.
Okay, we could have a long debate on this panel. I'm going to give Rachel and Rick just half a moment here. Mm-hmm. That's half a minute, actually. and then we'll go to the audience. I'll get everybody in, I promise. Rachel, any reaction?
Immediately, directly to Carl's point, just a reason why this table or community inclusion is so important is because when I think of or when I reflect on who I typically hear, you know, pipe up in a meeting or in a conversation about their community, it's your usual cast of characters, folks on the community board, people who are civil servants or civic-minded folks within their community. They're pulled into the infrastructure, they're coming to town hall meetings, they're writing in and offering their statements or their opinions on what happens. That is not the vast majority of people who live in a community. And it tends to be people who actually can afford the Whole Foods and the Trader Joe's, mm-hmm. and not the ones who can't, because mm-hmm. the ones who can't don't have that same kind of enfranchisement and don't have the space or the time after their two, sometimes three jobs, picking up children from daycare, or, you know, given the circumstances of their real lives, they're not engaged in that conversation in the same way. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Just with regard to, and this may not be, it is probably not going to be the most popularly held belief in the room, but it's something that at Right to the City we experience, we've learned, and we articulate and share quite a bit. Poor and working class people, we're fine to live together. We don't need, our communities need investment. Not rich people, but investment. We need our tax dollars returned back to the communities where they were produced in the first place. And we need for there to be progressive taxation that actually subsidizes our communities in a way that allows our working class and poor communities to be healthy all on their own. We're actually really fine to live together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's some philosophical questions, there's some practical questions about how to achieve any of these aims, there's some classic issues like whose interests are really represented in neighborhood planning. And by the way, how do you meet a diversity of needs? Because communities aren't monolithic. There are lots of different players. Rick, bear with me. I want to get the audience in, and then what we'll do is go down the panel, okay? Everyone will have a chance to jump in. Yes, we'll start over here. Briefly, everyone, please, a comment or question. Use the microphone, please, sir.
So, Moses, you raised the point in your speech that many of the new units that are being built are very large. You also raised the point that a lot of units are vacant. I would like the rest of the panel to comment. Is a big vacant units a problem? If they are, what do you do about them? What kind of tax or building code tools do you have? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So thank you for that. We're going to take a few questions, so we hear several.
Okay. It's a problem.
There's one right here in front. Can we get the microphone over here? Or do you have the mic? Okay. Go ahead, please.
Who does?
I'll come back to you.
So what?
Try and be brief. I'm Jose Lopez with Make the Road New York. I guess I had a two-part question. I'm just interested in the conversation around both kind of policy hooks and solutions to the current crisis, but also the responsibility, and I think we talked about it kind of at the back end of the panel, the responsibility of sharing the burden of our current crisis and thinking about, if we're talking about diversity in communities, not just talking about infrastructure and needs and the burden that poor communities have to face. And I think Rachel kind of nodded to that in saying that we're fine as, you back and brown working and poor communities living together. There are just a few things, and I think the current administration has taken a stab at trying to solve the problem, or thinking that they could solve the problem using the MIH framework. And I think that, you know, I guess in our opinion, the framework isn't necessarily properly aligned with the incomes of current residents in a lot of the neighborhoods like East New York, where we're talking about upzoning and new housing. And so I guess, I don't want to be long-winded here, but I just feel like the need is the need. And we know that there is a need in terms of new development, but we also know that there is a need in terms of the preservation of affordable housing for low-income communities. And I know we live in a system where sometimes, and we debate about this, and we probably will today, sometimes we say we can't build for poor people because it's just because we can't afford to do so. But again, I think the need is the need, and the solution cannot be to simply kind of leave families behind without affordable housing mm-hmm. and good jobs. So I guess my question is, important policy measures that we need to explore as we look towards 2040 in New York City, but also what is the responsibility of local government to push some of these higher income communities who may not be targeted for upzoning to make sure that they share the burden of housing working class and poor people across our city so that folks aren't continuously pushed out.
Jose, thank you. So questions here about public commitment and where the revenue is going to come from, not just regulatory approaches. Mm-hmm. This gentleman in front has had his hand up. Thank you so much for bringing the mic over. Thank you.
I'm John Manning. Back in the 1970s, inflation was getting out of control. In the 1980s, crime and welfare dependency were intractable problems that got tamed. This whole society is awash in debt. The foreclosure crisis you mentioned, student loan debt, MTA debt consuming a huge amount. It seems to me that this is perhaps the fundamental problem, all this debt that's on the books society-wide. Having a strategic plan to address it that includes haircuts on principal and interest rates, just getting all this debt down, mm-hmm. That would give us all kinds of options, from affordable housing to renovating subway cars, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's the fundamental problem that needs to be addressed.
Sir, thank you. So I know there is an important fiscal and governance component to the larger plan, though we didn't go into it on this particular panel. Thank you for bringing that point into view. We've heard three or four questions, comments. What I want to do is just go down the panel so we don't run out of time without hearing from our panelists again on any of these things, starting with Mike.
Well, one, we're not going to preserve or regulate our way out of our housing shortage. We have to build our way out of the housing shortage. All the issues are important.
I'm sorry, did you mean yes and? We need to do both?
Well, we could do that, but what I'm saying is we are not going to we need to build our way out of our affordable housing problem and our housing shortage problem. We can't regulate our way out of it. We can't preserve our way out of it. The other is also, we talk about rising rents, and, Furman Center, as well as the CHPC, did studies on gentrification that show that the people in the neighborhood actually benefit from the kind of new investment that takes place in the neighborhood. So it's not the bugaboo that it seems to be created here. And also the question of when you have an opportunity now to raise rents, what typically happens is that owners reinvest. We've seen when deregulation occurred, owners started to invest in their property so that now our housing stock is at the best quality it's been in quite some time. And we only have to look at other places, other housing stock in the city of New York, where you can't raise rents very easily, and we look at the quality of that housing, and we recognize that we need capital investment, and sometimes capital investment has to come from rising rents. So I would put those issues on the table as being something we should be considering.
Mike, thank you. And one thing we haven't touched on directly here, but it's central to housing affordability, of course, is the income side of the equation.
Yeah.
So we're not having a conversation about the minimum wage,
The
earned income tax credit,
right.
Other things to raise wages in an economy where it's been stuck on the bottom for quite a while. Michelle.
So just on the questions, one of the questions about are big vacant units a problem or are big units a problem? And, I would just say I have the privilege of sitting on the City Planning Commission with Carl. And not too long ago, we approved a 15,000 square foot home off of Park Avenue. It's a problem in certain sectors. certain demand sectors, and obviously, you know, we're having a conversation about smaller micro units at the lower end of the income scale, but meanwhile, at the upper end of the income scale, you know, there's very large units. So I think that conversation needs to be balanced for everyone. I think Jose brings up a very good point about the need is the need is the need is the need. We do need to increase incomes. Obviously, that's a huge piece of the problem, you know, moving to $15 an hour and beyond, having real workforce development opportunities and ladders for advancement. One of the things Fifth Avenue Committee does is job training and placement in sectors where folks can have living wages for themselves and their families. That's a critical piece of the puzzle. Oftentimes we talk about matching people to jobs without really looking at the skill gap and government actually investing in helping people gain the skills necessary to lift themselves out of poverty and move to mobility. I think you know, we absolutely need to look at rental subsidy as part of the solution. That's a key piece of this. And I think, you know, I would disagree again. The emphasis is important. You know, building more units is important.
I expected that.
building more units is important, but we have to preserve what we have. It's critically important that we preserve what we have. It's critically important that we preserve NYCHA and continue to invest in NYCHA.
No disagreement.
And then in terms of the debt is the problem, I think inequality is the problem. I think the concentration of wealth is the problem. I think the fact that we don't have a fair taxation system is the problem, and that is what leads to the debt.
Great. Rick, we have the outbreak of some consensus here. I just want to point that out. Well, at least some issues, but no.
I disagree completely. No, we can't build our way. We won't build our way out of the problem, but we have to build.
Right.
We can't get out of the problem without building. And the to me, the place we have to start is by recognizing that the market isn't going to be able to deliver neighborhoods that are both highly desirable and highly affordable. We have to have a non-market strategy, and that's sort of a hard thing. People just say, oh, we'll just get some development. We'll get a Whole Foods, but not too nice a Whole Foods. That doesn't work. What we have in San Francisco, a number of neighborhoods where we now have, you know, 30 or in one case 40% of the housing, permanently affordable social housing for low-income folks across several different income levels. And while in almost all of San Francisco, this fight about gentrification is like crippling, in those neighborhoods, it's not. That's the key to people being able to see that their neighborhood could get better and still be for them. And I just want to point out that it's like a vaccine. It's not just that the people who live in those units have stable rent and it's not going to go up. It's that it affects who's willing to move into the other market rate units. So you can welcome market rate housing into your neighborhood if you don't have to worry that it's going to flip the neighborhood. And if 30% of the population is forever going to be low income, there's just only so far up market your housing stock can go. And to me, that's the key to sort of this piece of the regional building problem. We have to make it not just symbolically clear, but actually real that people really benefit and that neighborhoods can be sustained while they build in order to get the building to happen. Because otherwise, people will say no. We won't allow it because they're right that they will be displaced.
Rick, thanks. You're bringing in a perspective from many other cities and helping us think through the dynamics of the situation, not just what we see today, but where this movie goes if you take certain steps. Carl, I think we're hearing in the last couple comments in particular a very strong echo of no one approach will do. We need multiple strategies to this. There are multiple facets to it.
So let me make four quick points. First of all, to Rick's point, we totally agree with exactly what Rick says, and that's exactly the theory behind mandatory inclusionary housing. And he's absolutely right that if you have a certain percentage of that housing being guaranteed affordable forever, it will also, through the market, affect what the market rate has and who will move into that market rate housing. But let me make just a few other points. First, the basic point, we have to both build and regulate. We can't just do one thing. We do have to regulate. We can't just let the market run rampant. But at the same time, we obviously have to build. Point number two, this is not just an urban problem. It's a regional problem. And we really need I don't actually believe that New York City can solve the affordability housing problem. We can address it. We can improve it. But we're not going to solve it unless there's a broader regional approach and it's more affordable housing, not just in the city, but in the surrounding region. Three, we are focused on higher income neighborhoods. That's where the housing demand is, and that's where mandatory inclusionary zoning is going to have its maximum impact, because that will be sort of self-subsidizing. That will be cross-subsidizing. It won't require public subsidy because the development itself will have to support the affordable housing, leaving money for the city to invest elsewhere in affordable housing. And finally, let's just face the reality here of what's causing the affordable housing problem beyond demand. And that is the basic absence of the federal government to make an investment in this whole area. So cities and counties, villages, even states have to do this on their own, and they have to do it out of their own resources. We are not building public housing because the last time we built public housing was when the federal government built public housing. Mm-hmm. And when the federal government could support ongoing subsidies for low-income families that go beyond just the affordability of building, but the affordability of occupancy. Mm-hmm. And until the federal government gets back into this in a robust way, this is going to be an issue that we, as cities all over the country, are going to have to continue to wrestle with as best we can. And in New York City, we have a lot of resources, more than other places, and in part that's because our economy is doing so well. But they're not unlimited. And so we're doubling the amount of money we're putting into affordable housing from the previous 10 years. But still, unless the federal government steps up, whether it's in this area or in terms of infrastructure and transportation and a whole vast area of domestic spending, this problem will continue to vex all of us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Cole. Mm-hmm. Rachel?
I almost get last word. I just want to draw from Rick and Carl's offers of social housing and put out probably one of the best ways to guarantee affordability in the long run, which is community-controlled housing, like community land trusts and housing cooperatives. I mean, if you look globally at cities around the world, there are many of them who are making use of this community-controlled infrastructure in very healthy ways, and it's really changing the dynamic of how housing gets built, gets maintained, and then is affordable throughout, you know, a whole community's lifetime there. So I'll say that piece. The second, in terms of the federal government, I agree completely. There's a deep responsibility in the federal government to invest in the creation and maintenance of affordable housing, but I won't let federal agencies off the hook that easy and say that their role is just a lack of investment. They are actually facilitating the wholesale push into the private market of single-family homes, public housing, units around the country that could be converted to affordable housing. So there's not only an absence of action, but there's a willful action being taken in order to do the opposite. And so this is an issue, you know, the housing issue, again, it comes back to our values as a society. It comes back to our values as a country, our values as human beings. If we believe that housing is a human right, then it completely shifts on its head how we approach the creation, maintenance, and subsidies that go to creating housing for communities of all kinds. And so this is a long-term question about hearts and minds. And we have to make decisions about how deep we're going to dig into shifting those hearts and minds in order to really solve the housing crisis, both through preservation and through new building.
Rachel, thank you. Before we thank the panel, everyone, we'll end on this note, I think, and great thanks for all the thoughtful contributions that you made. Regional planning and commitment building are difficult and absolutely essential for all the reasons we've heard. The housing market is regional. It's not limited to the city, but the city looms large in it, obviously. We've given thought to and we've talked about how to meet the needs of incumbents, of people in communities right now, as well as how to think ahead an entire generation, not easy for any of us to do. We brought Albany in to some extent and then Washington toward the end there. This is a picture that is bigger than the city when it comes to public commitments. And, of course, we talked about public roles as well as private ones and how the interaction between them is so very important. And I want to underscore again that the housing affordability challenge, which is not at all unique to New York, in fact, it's something of a an urgent challenge, unfortunately too quiet a crisis, throughout the country, wherever cities are economically successful, and in many other parts of the world as well. This problem of growth generating enormous amount of pressure, as Carl said at the outset. But you can't have an inclusive city without affordable housing, and yet we need to address these other components as well, like decent wages for good work, to be able to afford anything. I want to thank Moses for kicking us off and the RPA for giving us so much to react to. Join me in thanking the entire panel.